Welcome to Success Made to Last. I'm Tim Moore. This is the podcast that talks with people who strive for excellence. Brought to you by Blinkist, where you'll find thousands of nonfiction books condensed to 15 minutes so that you can test drive them or just browse them for the key ideas. That's Blinkist, B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. Today we have on the show what we like to call a good one. Capital G, capital O, someone who fulfills the promise inherent in Lincoln's famous phrase, whatever you are, be a good one. Good ones are rare. And our guest today is Professor Wilfred McClay. He's an historian and author of many books, most notably and recently, Land of Hope, An Invitation to the Great American Story. He is the G.T. and Libby Blankenship Chair in the History of Liberty, where he teaches students about the evolution of the concept of liberty in Western civilization, and he is also director of the Center for the History of Liberty, all at the University of Oklahoma. He has taught all over the country, including Georgetown, Pepperdine, Johns Hopkins, the University of Dallas, the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga, and Tulane. And he is a member of the U.S. Commission on the Semi-Quincentennial, which has
not
been
bad.
I practiced it earlier too, Professor. Which has been charged with planning the celebration of the nation's 250th birthday in 2026. Welcome to our podcast, Professor McClay.
It is a pleasure. I'm very happy to be with you, and I'm happy to be anywhere in whistling distance of the word success. So thank you very much.
Well, in the spirit of a podcast, I often ask questions of people about, you know, the paths they've taken to where, you know, how they've gotten there. You know, success comes in many forms. It's not always monetary. It's, you know, doing great things and having you know, goals that that are larger than yourself, and writing great books. And you mentioned before we got on the air that you're from the Baltimore area originally, but talk a little bit about your early days and the dreams that you had as a young person and those hopes and that you had, and how, if at all, they directed you to the path that you finally got on.
That's a great question. It's a question nobody's ever asked me, so it'll be fun to try to answer it. I think actually my adult career is sort of a reaction against the kind of insensate, present-oriented qualities that I had as a young person. You know, I wasn't interested in history. When I went to college, I always was interested in the wisdom of the past. That's something I always had a lot of respect for. And but from the youngest days, you know, I was really interested in was astronomy. And and I had my best friend in all through elementary school was a guy who we had an astronomy club we called the Stargazers Club. And and this guy, he actually went on to become an astronaut, Steve Hawley.
Oh.
He was the fellow who married Sally Ride. Anyway, I've lost touch with Steve, but he was a great, great friend. And, you know, that was the kind of orientation. My dad worked in aerospace at Westinghouse near Baltimore, the old Linthicum plant. He was a mechanical engineer who had, and actually my view of America, I think, is heavily influenced by my dad, because my dad was a guy who came from nothing, less than nothing, I think, and made something of himself grasped the opportunities that were available to him. He had a great visceral love of this country, and I inherited it from him. I went to college. I started working after college. I got a job in publishing as an editor at a place called the U.S. Naval Institute. Why I ended up there, it was largely a matter that I'm good with language, And I was living in Annapolis, and the U.S. Naval Institute is part of the Naval Academy, you know, so they are the publishing arm of all the sea service academies, among other things. They publish terrific books. You know, a book I worked on was, you ever heard of a book called The Hunt for Red October?
Yes, of course.
We published Tom Clancy's first book at the Institute. So we did mostly fleet guides and technical works, but we did do... Anyway, I was hired, and I became the naval history guy. So I edited books on naval history. Well, I became fascinated by seeing how historians recover the past, reconstruct the past, how they investigate the past, what's involved in researching and archives. I'd never done any of that. And I ended up, I don't want to name any names, but some of my authors were demon researchers who didn't know how to write. So I spent a lot of time massaging their prose and learning about the English language, but also learning about how historical research was done. So I became more and more and more fascinated, by what is the meaning of America? And basically, I ended up going to graduate school at Johns Hopkins partly because that was the only place where they didn't laugh at me for saying, you know, when they would ask me, what do you want to study? And I said, what are you really interested in? And instead of saying, I'm interested in the experience of marginalized mine workers in North Georgia between 1873 and 1877, I said I was interested in the meaning of America. And the one guy who didn't laugh at me, I became his student at Johns Hopkins. I met my wife there, and that's sort of the path I've been on ever since. I've always had, within the historical profession, a bit of a heterodox view because of the fact that I've come to the subject with love. Not that I'm uncritical, or, you know, heaven forbid. But I didn't come with a kind of hostility or distaste for the subject. So you can imagine that some of the things going on now, like the 1619 Project in the New York Times, are not pleasing to me. But that's how I came to it. I became really interested in the ways that the ways that we shape our sense of the past. And then I think a further development was I met this crazy Hungarian American historian named John Lukács, who wrote a book about what he called historical consciousness, and that book made me realize that how important our, not just our knowledge of the past, but our sense of connection to the past is. And one of the things now I'm very concerned about is Americans' lack of connection to their own past. So, I was asked by several people, several publishers, would I be interested in writing a textbook? And I said, no, I know we need one. We don't have a good one. This is true, really, Tim. I'm not exaggerating. But I didn't want to be the one to do it. And then finally, my publisher, the man who would become my publisher, Roger Kimball of Encounter Books, called me up one Sunday afternoon, caught me in a soft mood. My heart was chastened by a good church service earlier that day, and I was feeling very open and also feeling I really wanted to do something good, and he talked me into it. So thus Land of Hope, the book that you mentioned in the intro, came out of that, and it's kind of changed my life because I'm doing interviews all the time, although you asked a question no one has ever asked at the outset, and that's fun.
I'm always amazed at the richness of the answers that I get from people, irrespective of their domain. And I do think, in part, the answers are rich because people you know, particularly people who are, you know, on a book tour or, you know, interviewed a lot or whatever, you know, there's a set of answers in all of our heads. You know, you sort of push the button and there's the answer, right? And I think it really gets people to talk about something that's important to them. And it's important to us because we really are interested in how people find their way. I'll get back to the book, I promise, in a minute. But I do want to ask
this is great.
To talk a little bit about the Center for the History of Liberty and your program. I went to your website and looked at it. And, geez, I wish I didn't live 300 miles from Norman because I'd go and sit in on the classes. It looks fabulous. Tell us a little bit about the program and your students.
Well, okay. Now I know you're a Texan, so I have to tread lightly here. Those listeners who don't know, there's this huge rivalry between the two states.
And, well, my father is an OU fan, and I'm a Texas fan.
That's right. So your family's helped together through all that. Ah, that's tough. The chair, you know, the History of Liberty, I have this G.T. and Flintley Blankenship chair of the History of Liberty. That chair was created for my predecessor, a very distinguished guy named Rufus Fears, whom some of your listeners may know of because I think he has the record for the most lectures given for the teaching company. Or they now call it the Great Courses of anybody, kinds of things. And he does, one of the things he does is the history of freedom. He does things on Churchill. He was quite a Churchill scholar. He was a scholar of Acton, you know, who was a great partisan of liberty, of Whig liberty. Rufus died in... I guess he did in late 2012, suddenly of a heart attack. And they approached me and asked me if I'd be interested in the chair. And I was in Tennessee at the time, living in this beautiful mountaintop house near Chattanooga. And I don't know what possessed me, but I said, well, I'll at least go out there to see the place, do an interview and all that. So I did, and I absolutely fell in love with it. I mean, the OU is more than a football team. like the Bee Gees song, you know, more than a woman. This is more than a football team. And this gets to the students, and I'll talk about the courses I teach. But we have amazing students, and part of it is that our former president, David Boren, who was former governor of the state and then United States Senator for, I think, 3 terms, and he was chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. He was actually touted as a substitute for Bill Clinton. I mean, you remember Bill Clinton had a very bad 1994, the midterm elections, and the Democrats started looking around for a substitute. They were looking at David Boren pretty closely. But around that time, he decided to retire from politics and come to OU. And he proved to be a transformational leader for this campus. And one of the things he did was he recruited National Merit Scholars like crazy. And so we have had, for most of the last 20 years or so, OU has had more National Merit Scholars than any public university in the country. And for the last 4 or 5, most of the time I've been at OU, we've had the most of any college. So now, look, I'm not a big fan of standardized tests at all, and the National Merit Scholarships are really based on a standardized test. But you get the point. We get kids from other places. We get a lot of Texans. We get a lot of Nebraskans, Californians, you know, Chicago, Florida, you know, all over, because of the great deals we offer the National Merit Scholars. We basically will pay them to come here. Administration probably would not appreciate me putting it that way, but that's actually true. So I am fortunate enough that for reasons having to do with the structure of the place, I get a lot of these students in my classes, okay? Now, what? Now you asked about the classes. What? Couple of things. I created a course called The Idea of Freedom because I thought that would be a great thing to, it would follow in Rufus's footsteps. It would fit the chair. My own background is in American intellectual and cultural history. So I'm a student of American religion and of great American authors of various kinds, intellectual history. So I was able to segue into that pretty easily. And we look at the idea of freedom from going all the way back to antiquity, the Greeks, and all of that, up to the day before yesterday. Well, that idea works so well, the sort of the idea, making an idea or a word one of these big keywords, the center of the course. I went on to create a series of what I call idea courses. So I have the idea of community, the idea of virtue, the idea of tradition, tradition is a very tough sell with young people. The idea that tradition should have any authority. So that's a particularly challenging but rewarding course. The idea of justice, which, needless to say, the first 4 weeks of it are reading Plato's Republic, but a bunch of others that I'm not thinking of right now. There may be three or four others, and I just rotate them. So I have these idea courses, and I do what are called capstone courses, where students do extensive term papers, and I work with them very individually. I like to also do courses on particular individuals, like Tocqueville, Alexis de Tocqueville, whose book, Democracy in America, is probably the single best book on America, even though it was written over 150 years ago. I try to have them read important classic texts, lots of primary sources. And my classes are very discussion-oriented, so I'm constantly going around playing Socrates and accosting them. What do you mean by that? What do you mean by that? And fortunately, you know, all they say about snowflakes and all that, I don't run into that with my students. My students are not snowflakes. They're terrific. So I have the best students I've ever had have been here at OU. And I've had a lot of freedom to develop these courses. There's one other I should mention, and I try to say it quickly, that has been a bit of a sensation. I discovered a syllabus for a course that, you know, the poet W.H. Auden had taught in the University of Michigan in 1941, right before American entry into the war, you know. And it was this amazing course that's kind of like a great books course, but all in one semester. And I saw this before I came to OU, and I thought, boy, I'd like to try this course myself sometime. But I couldn't do it with the students I had in Tennessee. You know, God bless them. There just wasn't a critical mass of really good students. You know, anywhere you go, I've found the best could be good anywhere. And I think that's true. It's absolutely true. People should never overlook employers who think, well, this person went to Yale, this person went to Sam Houston. Well, personally, I'd actually take the Sam Houston person up the Yale person sight unseen, but we would never underestimate the products of institutions that may not have the big gold plated names. I decided to offer this course when I came here, and where we have all these hotshot students, and I got a colleague to agree to co-teach it with me. And then we realized because of the nature of the curriculum, you know, of the course, it was a lot of old, you know, older, not dead white males, to use the sort of somewhat reductive figure of the time. And we knew we were going to run into trouble politically if we didn't get some cover from on high. So we went to the provost at that time, who was a marvelous guy, a scholar of classics, just a splendid, splendid person, and under 40 at that time. He was not yet 40. And he looked it over and said, yeah, I'll support this on one condition. I got to be a part of it. He wanted in. So we put on this course. We advertised it around campus as this is the hardest course you'll ever take. It was a sort of a Marine Corps-like appeal. You know, if we don't know whether you can do this. You want to try, give it a try. And we've been oversubscribed every semester. And it is a fantastic course. I just had a couple come back to visit me last week, who said, you know, we want the Auden course was the pinnacle of our lives. We wanted to just come back and see you and recapture some of that. And, so I've had a great experience here teaching, and I'm sure it would have been just as good in Austin, though.
Well, you know, it's funny that I've heard you on another podcast talk about the students at OU, and I was trying to tickle for that because I was impressed when I heard it then. I'm impressed now. To buttress your point, my daughter works for a Fortune 20 company here in Texas. I'll leave the name of the company out. But they only recruited three schools in the United States, year after year, three schools. University of Texas, Texas A&M, and the University of Oklahoma. It sounds like you're right.
Yeah. Although, you know, the Aggie part must be a little hard for you to take. But
we don't play them anymore, so I can get over it.
That's true.
I can get over it. And every year, my brother and I, you know, I get on the phone just before the Red River Shootout, but that's another issue for another day. But yes. That is a good segue to your book. You know, Professor, I published books for a portion of my career. You know, I got to publish New York Times bestsellers and stuff like that. And so I think of myself as someone, you know, who knows a good book when he's seen it, if I can pat myself on the back. And I've read a lot of U.S. history. And so the notion of reading a survey of the United States history seemed a bit redundant to me. But I must say it is a remarkable book. The writing in it can only be described as elegant and graceful. And I found that reading that book that there were moments in it, as much as I've read, as many books as I've read about American history, where I had to stop and say, you know, that's right, I hadn't thought about that before. And to be able to do that in a survey is magnificent. So kudos to you. But let's talk about the subtitle of this book. No problem. Subtitle, where you say it's an invitation to the great American story. I spoke with one of your colleagues on a podcast, in the broadest sense of the word, colleagues, H.W. Brands at University of Texas recently. Uh-huh. And he, great, great conversation. And you can,
he's
you can
a listen to guy. It. Up.
Oh, my God, he's good. He's fabulous. He churns out a book, almost every year.
I know.
But in any case, he talked at length about the importance of the word story to an historian. And then you used that word in your subtitle. You know, tell us why that word's so important to you and to him. I mean, you know, we're talking about two great American historians here.
Well, yeah, I think Hal Brands is a greater historian than me, but I would definitely agree that story is you know, it's the way that we remember things is if they are embedded in or some way connected to hanging on a story. To present the past just in terms of a kind of set of analytic observations or abstract processes. It's first of all, it's very difficult to remember even to sequence things in the way that we actually experience life, but it's difficult to feel a sense of connection to them. In fact, the abstract language that so much of what we have pounded into us in graduate school is a distancing device. So story is something that brings you in. It brings you in and it carries you along. And there's a lot of things in life that can only be understood through narrative, through the sequence of things. I mean, this is really an outrageous comparison to make of myself, but you know, why do we think Jesus taught in parables and told stories? The kingdom of heaven is like, you know, why did he do that? Why did he teach in that way? Why did he? And these stories are often, you know, people puzzle over, how do you interpret them? What does this mean? What does the parable of the sower mean in practical terms? Well, that's the nature of a story. It's that a story can hold together a lot of disparate elements, some of which are moving in opposite directions or lending themselves to different interpretations, and yet be true. So that's part of what I tried to do. Certainly one of the motives for writing this is a feeling that the critical side of American historiography, historical writing, had gotten way out of hand, that we had lost perspective on what is fine and noble and glorious even about our history. And part of the problem is that, people always say, well, our kids don't learn American history. Well, part of the problem is they don't learn non-American history either. So that, just to give you one example that's, I think, somewhat current, when I teach my students about slavery, and one of the first things in the Idea of Freedom course, where I can deal with slavery more thematically, I start saying, well, you know, the first thing to know about slavery is that its existence has been more the rule than the exception in human history. And I just pause and let that sink in, and they look at me like I'm some sort of a nut at first. And then I start, you know, giving a recitation of all the instances in human history, including in, you know, the civilizations of classical antiquity, and what an extraordinary thing it is that somehow in the 18th century, people began to look at this differently. And where did they begin to look at it differently? Beginning in the United States, and the first anti-slavery movement of the modern period begins here. So, I mean, it's again something the 1619 people who were journalists and not historians seem unaware of. So people need to know America. It's one thing to compare America to a standard of perfection. We fall short. We don't have perfect equality. We don't have any number of things that we would think we would like to have. I'm actually sure we do want perfect equality, or what it would take to achieve it. But leave that aside. It's one thing to compare ourselves to an abstract standard and say we fall short. It's another thing to say compared to what actual country, what actual it's something that students don't know enough about the pre-modern world. They don't know enough about the lives of the indigenous peoples whom they so romanticize. They don't realize that the ship that brought the 20 Africans to Jamestown, which is what the 1619 thing is meant to mark. They did not bring slavery to the Western Hemisphere. Slavery was already going strong in the Western Hemisphere, including enslavement of the indigenous peoples by other indigenous peoples. And I could go on and on about that, and I do, until they can't really take any more of it. But I want them to understand. You must think about. I would love to be able to show to a class the new movie, Mr. Jones, which I recommend to all your listeners. It's about the cover-up of the great Soviet-Ukrainian famine. It's a very powerful movement. It's also about the journalistic malfeasance of the New York Times, for which its reporter won a Pulitzer Prize, Shades of the 1619 Project. But, you know, the pursuit of the socialist dream, the communist dream, in Stalin's Russia had such horrific human consequences. Although you don't need to look at the past, you look at China today. Look at the Uyghurs. Look at slave-like conditions of so much Chinese labor. There's a lot to be done now, even on the issue of slavery, which still exists in some countries. Mauritania.
Exists still in West Africa. Black slavery exists in the Muslim world, exists in China. Funny how none of those people I just mentioned are white.
Yeah. But leaving aside the issue, Ray said, the thing is that you by obsessing about ways in which we fell short, and grievously short, I'm not soft peddling it, of our ideals.
This is
what a ray of sunshine we are in the very dark history of human exploitation of other human beings. And I don't blink that in the book. I don't try to drive my readers into a sense of despair at how horrible it is to be human. But I want them to see that what we have done, the American dispensation has been so extraordinary, exceptional, as some people like to say, against the dark background of most human history. So I think it would be great if kids could learn more about other histories and other places, compared to which America starts to look pretty darn good, pretty amazing. So that's what I think. I don't want to pick on Howard Zinn too much, but you know of Howard Zinn, maybe have read his People's History.
I remember when that book was published. I was living in Boston at the time, and
it's about 71.
I think I may have read it, and even back then, when I was younger, you know, and more susceptible to, soft, woolly-headed notions, I thought it was a disgraceful book.
It is.
That's my opinion.
Yeah, I think it is. But let me say this. The disgraceful thing is not that Zinn wrote it. I mean, anybody can write a book. And you know, it's not a bad thing to challenge the consensus. But
correct.
The problem is that Zinn became the consensus. Zinn, 3 million copies of his book have sold.
Yeah.
It's a sort of reflexive response that so many young people have to American history. It's a story of abusive power, of race privilege, of all of these things that we now hear slogans shouted in the streets. And what's happened is, I think we've lost perspective. I don't think we historians have exactly crowned ourselves with glory in that. I think we don't think enough about what are we teaching young people that they can carry into the work of citizenship, of being responsible citizens in a republic that's self-governing, ideally, that we govern ourselves. I think that the emphases are all in the other direction. They're making young people cynical about citizenship, or they think citizenship means marching in the streets, which is not. I wouldn't say that there aren't times when it's appropriate. It's certainly, although I would say breaking windows and maybe dumping tea in the Boston Harbor. I could make a little exception for that act of vandalism. But, they're not learning how our system incorporates mechanisms for that allow for peaceable deliberation, for deliberation. And deliberation means deciding together, reasoning together, but you need the right kind of institutions to allow that and to mediate that. And again, I try to show how they arise. I think one of the things that's been really gratifying about the reception of the book is that people who have told me, you know, I really get what the Constitution is about. I took courses on it. That's what I try to do in the book. There's a lot of details left out. Surprisingly, I haven't gotten much complaint about that. I do get, you know, there are people who say, why don't you talk about the Battle of Shiloh in more detail or that kind of thing. And I have had Texans complain about my neglect of Texas history. But admiringly, they said, I like the book. You could have had a little bit more about this or that. But and it leaves off basically the detailed coverage at after, you know, 1991, 92, the end of the Cold War. And so I have brief accounts of the Clintons' election administration. And I say brief, I mean, there are like 2-3 paragraphs. Clinton and George W. Bush and Obama. And a little bit on Trump, very much less. I suppose I'll have more on, you know, I might even want to reconsider that last chapter once, if we ever have a second edition, which I hope we will. I wanted to give people an honest but inspiring book, or inspiring but honest, however you want to put that. Because I think there's reason to be proud and grateful. There's a huge number of reasons to be proud and grateful of the country in which we find ourselves. It has to be bolstered by, colored by an awareness of the darkness and the problems that beset us. So I give plenty of attention to that. I haven't had many complaints. There are always going to be people complain about a textbook, but I've had very few complaints about my being sugarcoating the past. And I don't think I do. What I think is as much a sin as sugarcoating is sour coating or bitter coating, to coin a term, to make the past, the author of the 1619 Project said, racism, anti-black racism, is in the DNA of the American people. I think that A is not true. It's simply, you know, I mean, it's a non-falsifiable, you know, a statement. But it's also not a hopeful statement. There is no hope for us if that's true. And I, you know, you mentioned the subtitle of my book. I want to say a word about the title, if you don't mind, Land of Hope. It did strike me as I took the broad view of American history. And I've taught the survey course many times, all that. So you have to step back, or else students are just, they're going to listen to you droning on and writing everything down, but nothing is going to stick with them. And it struck me, what really is distinctive about this country? And there are many things, but I think that I do not think you can understand America, even now in this very troubled time. You cannot understand America and Americans without taking into account the element of the aspirational quality. This is why the name of your show immediately turned me on, because I think we are an aspirational people. That's why so many people come here. Have come here from the first Norse explorers to the current throngs that want to come in over the border or by our seas or whatever means they can. People still want to come here, and it's yes, we have opportunities, but I think it's this unquenchable or unbeatable sort of sense in some people that life is not about accepting what it is you're born into, that we can, as we say in America, we can make something of ourselves. That's a really amazing phrase when you think about it, to make something of yourself. I think there's never been a country, a nation of people sort of self-selected to those qualities to the degree that we are. So to call ourselves a land of hope, it has several different layers of meaning, and I hope readers will catch some of them. But that's the biggest, I think, is that it is a land that is suffused with the sense that we are not condemned to live out our lives under the conditions of our birth, that we are resourceful. We are, there are possibilities. America is a land of possibility. That's another way. Reagan liked that way of putting it. America is a land of possibility. I like it too. But hope is, hope is also a kind of virtue of the soul. It's a theological virtue. And, I mean it a little bit in that way. And certainly the Puritans and many have come here in search of religious liberty. Many have come here simply for the search for material well-being, or some or combination of the two, freedom to be different, to be the way they are, and not to have to conform themselves to a dominant culture that it, usually with religion doesn't permit worship after the manner that the group chooses. I mean, that's certainly the Puritans and the Pilgrims, the earliest New England settlers. That's a big motive for them. So land of hope, I mean, it's a land, and may I say also land of hope. I think there's a lot of people say, well, America is an idea. And there's some truth to that. But I also think America is a land. We are a country. We have a history. We have particular heroes. We can admire the heroes of other countries. You know, I tremendously admire, this is a sort of, maybe it is a secret, I tremendously admire the Finns, who seem to me a very, very different from the rest of Scandinavia. And I know what they did in the Winter War. One of the really extraordinary events of valor in modern military history. So I can admire people of other, it doesn't mean that I think America is the locus of every great and good thing in the world. But it is my country, and we all put our feet on the ground in a particular place. We are buried in a particular place. We produce in a particular place. We have a particular language. I'm really not, I'm increasingly want to distance myself from the idea that America is nothing but an idea. So land of hope is a deliberate way of kind of planting myself on the, you know, when we go to Arlington National Cemetery, I think we're not just paying tribute to the American idea. We're paying tribute to men and some women who sacrificed themselves or at least gave their lives in terms of their careers. Not all of them die in combat, but for the sake of the country, not for the sake of some sort of universal idea, although America does kind of attempt to embody universal. So it's complicated. It's complicated. But I don't want the land part to get left out, that we are particular people with a particular history, some of it very peculiar, you know? And it's an invitation to the Great American Story, because I want to get people inside the party, you know? I want them to get them in the door, and then once I've got them in the door, they can read a lot of other people, including Howard Zinn, and make up their own minds. But, you know, they're part of, this is what kills me about these morose young people that I see around me, not so much at OU, but they're living in one of the greatest sort of experiments in the history of the human race. And they're going around being all bummed out about everything. Come on, get with it. This is arguably the most exciting thing going in the history of nations, is the nation of which they're a part.
Well, as you well know, the Jacobin mind is a dark place to go into, and it's not a place of logic and reason. It's a place of it's where the goblins live, and where the dragons live.
And those dragons are going to eat you. You go in the door, and you think they're your pets. They're going to eat you.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, I'll leave you. I have a hard stop at the top of the hour, and I bet you I could talk with you about 5 hours. We will have to do this again, but I'm reminded. Because I had a lot of questions I haven't asked. I'm reminded, when you talk about land, you know, the great American author Larry McMurtry, has written about novels.
He's just a great... We can talk a lot about him.
Well, we'll
Boats
do that.
Of Dove is a great American book. It's one of the great books.
All of them are. But, you know, in one of his nonfiction books, he talked about his family, and he talked about how important the need for land was in moving people across the United States. And, you know, his grandfather settled in up near Archer City in about 1870. So the Comanches were still out. They were still living in Palo Duro Canyon. They were not in Indian territory yet. They had not been finally defeated. And he talks about how ludicrous it was for someone to be out that far in the Comanche area, but it was the need for land, and that's such an important concept in American history and in the drive toward the West. So I guess another layer of that that word too. I'd love to talk with you again sometime, only about your book, but about American history in general.
I would love it, and we're almost neighbors, aren't we?
I don't know about that. I'm 190 miles south of Dallas, and Dallas is 190 miles south of you. So in the Midwest, that's kind of neighbors, though.
Well, it is a bit. It's a fur piece, that's for sure. But
don't let the word get out.
But I really like. I'm a big fan of Texas. I definitely, we call the OU Texas football game the week of that, we call it the High Holy Days. And of course, this year we won't have it, apparently, but so don't mention this around Oklahoma, but I'm a big fan of I root for OU because that's the religious observance one must make, but I'm a big, big, big fan of Texas. I lived in Dallas for a little while at the University of Dallas, and I like that a lot. I like, Austin,
it's
I think.
This is a great state to live in, and I'm so happy. I feel, there are other places that would be just as great, New Mexico and Oklahoma, and those are two that jump to mind, but it's a fabulous place to live, and I've said to anybody who will listen that I've never been more place happy, if you will, in my entire life, and not that the places I lived in before were horrible, and I was unhappy. I had a great life before I got here, but this is a just a stunningly fabulous place to live. And
I agree.
And so I'll leave on that mark, and we'll do this again. We'll call that a wrap. And for those of you out there listening to this, please go out and buy Land of Hope, An Invitation to the Great American Story, especially if you have kids. You will be happy that you did so. And Professor, thank you very much. And for all of you out there, I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Remember to go to successmadetolast.com to register for our newsletter filled with fun information about our future guests and other stuff in general. Last week I wrote about the birth of country rock in Bakersfield, California.
Ooh.
And go to your podcast distributor, iTunes, Spreaker, etc., and rate our show. Until next time, go out there and live the best version of you. Cheers.
So let me tell you a little bit about Blinkist. Blinkist is the most useful app on my phone. And it's really hard to find time to sit down and read and learn more. And when you don't have free time, you can't read or work on personal development. There's this incredible app that solves this problem, and I highly recommend it. It's called Blinkist. Blinkist is really unique. It works on my iPhone, and it could work on your tablet or web browser as well. Blinkist takes the best key takeaways, the need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books, and condenses them into just 15 minutes that you can read or listen to. Successful people, like business leaders, are well known for reading lots of books, and Blinkist is made for busy people like you who want to get the main points of a book quickly so you can start using that information right away. And with its audio feature, Blinkist makes it easy to finish a book during your commute, or lunch break, or while you exercise. There's 12 million plus people using Blinkist right now, and it's got a growing library of self-help, business, health, history books. And you can go to Blinkist.com to see some of the latest titles. I like Blinkist because listening to some of the most popular books that I just haven't found time to get to, including Alexander Hamilton by Ron Chernow and Super Thinking by Gabe Weinberg. Two great books. So right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. You can go to Blinkist.com/success and try it free for 7 days and save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist, BLINKIST.com/success to start your free 7-day trial today. Give it a shot. You will love microburst learning from Blinkist. We'll be right back.